Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan and I'm delighted to say I have an all-female panel in studio with me tonight. And they are Breed Smith, People Before Profit TD for Dublin South Central, Holly Cairn, Social Democrat TD for Cork West, Nasa Horrigan, Green Party TD for Dublin Central, Dr. Rona Mahoney, Executive Director of the Women and Children's Clinical Academic Directorate in the Ireland East Hospital Group and former Master of the National Maternity Hospital, Catherine Cox, Head of Communications at Family Carers Ireland, and Sinead O'Carroll, editor of thejournal.ie. Now, we want to hear from you, so do please get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie, or tweet to @latedebaterte, hashtag RTELD. Now, this evening we got the news that many have been dreading, the news that the COVID-19 outbreak has claimed its first life. Here is the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Holohan, speaking at the briefing by the National Public Health Emergency Team this evening.
Unfortunately, I'm reporting the first death of a patient with COVID-19 in this country. It was a female from the east of the country with an underlying medical condition. I'm also telling you that we have 9 new cases diagnosed today. 5 of them are in the south of the country. 4 being males, all associated with travel, 1 being a female associated with contact with a confirmed case. There's also 1 male from the south associated with contact with a confirmed case, 2 males from the east associated with travel, and 1 male also from the east associated with contact with a confirmed case.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has declared the outbreak to be a pandemic.
We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic. Pandemic is not a word to use lightly or carelessly. Describing the situation as a pandemic does not change WHO's assessment of the threat posed by the virus. We have never before seen a pandemic sparked by a coronavirus. WHO has been in full response mode since we were notified, and we have rung the alarm bell loud and clear.
And that was the WHO Director General, Tedros Ghebreyesus, there. Rona O'Mahony, we're hearing a lot about hospitals having to postpone and cancel elective procedures and surgeries and move people on if they can at all. But of course, babies can't be postponed. So how are you preparing for this within the National Maternity Hospital?
Yeah, absolutely. And just to say, we do fully expect to be consistently delivering our babies over the next while. We'll take the usual measures, you know, and the first is the really important public health messaging to patients coming, you know, and that is, first of all, avoiding exposure to this. So we're really appealing to every single person in the country, not just pregnant women, but everyone to take responsibility for this and to take this on board. So the first thing, reducing exposure. So that is avoiding, you know, places where you may come into contact with this. So that's people who've travelled from areas, avoiding areas, all of that advice, washing hands, you know, respiratory etiquette. So coughing into hankies, you know, if you have to, into the elbow, disposing of those hankies, making sure that, you know, you are avoiding contact, and then obviously cleaning the whole time, the alcohol gels and soap. And that applies to all pregnant women. The big message, though, is also to stay out of hospital if you can. And the really important thing is, if you think, you know, that you are affected by this, to ring your GP. And if you can't get hold of your GP, you ring 112 or 999. And there's an assessment made on the phone to see whether or not you should be tested. And if you are tested then, and, you know, you are positive, then measures can be taken. And hopefully we'll treat a lot of people out of hospital, even when pregnant.
Yeah, so for that, some people will know, remember, if they're not pregnant right now, of those regular visits to the maternity hospital and lining up with your chart on your lap. Are you saying to women now that if you can, you don't need to come in for those checks?
So basically, we're seeing all essential checks. So I think what we'd be doing is reducing non-essential activity in the hospital, so we can really focus on women having babies and focus on preventing this disease and ameliorating it. So we will have, first of all, we're asking people who don't need to come to the hospital not to come to the hospital. So for routine antenatal visits, we're asking women to come on their own and for their partners not to come with them. Of course, partners can come in labour. We're asking children not to come into the hospitals. We will have isolation facility. Of course, it'll be the concept of a sort of a hospital within a hospital where we can care for patients who are affected with COVID.
But you don't, there isn't an ICU in Hollis Street as of now?
Absolutely, we don't have an ICU. And of course, that's one of the big, you know, drivers for us to have, to be part of a big campus that has all the ICU facility. We don't at the moment.
So what happens if you need one?
Yeah, absolutely. And it will arise. I mean, the first thing is we are going to have patients infected with COVID. In the main, those patients will be well. And that's the really important message, is that what we see in pregnancy appears to be a sort of age-related presentation of COVID. And by that, I mean that in the under 40 age group, generally speaking, these patients are weathering this disease well. And, you know, we're not seeing such high mortality rates in this age group, which is good. Pregnancy doesn't seem to make this worse. So we're not seeing an excess mortality or morbidity in pregnant patients, which is a little bit unlike the H1N1 experience we had when
the swine flu, as we
And what we saw there was that pregnant women had a preponderance of pneumonia. And we did see that it disproportionately affected women, particularly in the third trimester of pregnancy. So we will be watching carefully for that, although the data so far doesn't suggest that.
Although pregnant women are being asked, they're asked to consider themselves a vulnerable group and to take extra precautions.
Yeah, and I think that's partly why, because of our experience with swine flu, our experience with flu in general. But in terms of, you know, what we can do, you know, we will be carrying on as normal. The babies do have to come. We fully expect that we will deliver patients who have COVID, and we will deliver their babies as we usually do. We have isolation facilities, negative pressure rooms. We can deliver women safely. We have staff who have the kit and who have the training to do that. On kit, just one appeal: will people please stop robbing masks and robbing personal protective equipment?
We are hearing this from all hospitals all over the place,
absolutely,
that people are actually coming in with buckets and emptying sanitizer,
and also buying up stock of masks. You know, the masks have not been shown to be beneficial for low-risk people in the population. And what it does is, masks in that case, they stop you touching your face. But actually, when we're using them in a clinical setting, we're using them because we're very close to patients. And COVID is spread by droplet, you know what I mean? So when you're very close to a patient, then the risk of droplet transmission increases. It only infects you when it gets into your mucous membranes. You know, skin to skin, it doesn't. But the problem is, we all touch our faces and touch our mucous membranes. That's probably how most of us are going to get infected. So
I think all of us should go on a course to teach us to stop touching our faces. It's because it's such a behaviour that's hard to stop.
And once you think about it, so we do have isolation facilities. We will be creating HDU facilities in the hospitals. And of course, we will be working with our colleagues across the country. And occasionally, patients will be transferred to ICU facility. And all of the hospitals, you know, have been working together. I have to commend the HSE. They're really doing a tremendous job. You know, they're having daily conference calls. Tremendous amount of planning has gone into this. The big focus being on increasing intensive care beds and increasing HDU beds across the whole hospital system.
An issue that must be of concern to you and to everyone working in every hospital in the country is staffing levels. And what happens when it comes into your staff cohort, as it almost inevitably will, and your staff have to self-isolate. And then and the other question, of course, is there's an expectation that at some stage down the line we're going to close the schools. And then what do you do?
Yeah, and that is problematic, you know. And so the big thing is going to be redeploying our skill sets. So we are very conscious of that. So the first thing we have to do is, like our patients, like everyone in this country, we are working hard to protect ourselves and therefore taking all the precautions of hand washing and wearing appropriate equipment and taking appropriate steps when we're dealing with patients. So we are also working hard not to become infected and to keep well during this, the next few weeks particularly. And because we're reducing, I suppose, elective work and non-essential work, that means there's more of us then to be deployed to the critical areas and where we're needed.
And that the recruitment ban being effectively lifted, is it going to be easy to very quickly get nurses and medics in place?
The problem will be in the highly specialised, so
which is
neonatal
ICU.
Intensive care, theatre nurse intensive care, exactly. I mean, we can train people up to a certain point and we can retrain people, but that is not the same as having people who have years of experience and years of training under their belt. But it will be a case of everyone doing their best. And what we'd be doing is, I suppose, deploying skill sets. So it could be that someone like me is better off doing basic work on a ward, you know, and letting a registrar do more familiar medical work. So we do have to be imaginative across the system in terms of how we work and how we use our skills.
Yeah, Catherine, carers. And I've been thinking a lot about carers in recent days and the situation that they find themselves in now. Because all of those issues that, that Rona was talking about there apply to carers in terms of keeping yourself well, what you do. You're dealing with a vulnerable vulnerable person. Yeah. Talk to me about what you're thinking about.
Yeah, so, I mean, we know there's 355,000 carers across the country providing care. Over 100,000 of them are providing full-time care 24/7 to highly dependent people, and quite a number of them would be in the older person's bracket, so they would be in the vulnerable categories. The kinds of issues, I suppose, that we have, and we've brought these to the HSE and carers are bringing them up with us, is the biggest probably concern is what happens if the carer gets this. So if the family carer gets this, they're the one providing full-time care for their loved one, and in the situation maybe they're asked to self-isolate, who's going to care for the person they're caring for? So that's a huge concern.
And what are you hearing back from the HSE?
We're still waiting on guidelines specifically around to support family carers. So the guidelines at the moment, and we are, you know, telling people to go to our website where we have the HSE guidelines, but there aren't any specifically for the family carers. So carers are writing themselves to the HSE. I have a carer in Wexford who wrote today. She has two boys who she is the primary carer for. Her husband died, so she's on her own doing that. Now, her two boys are on the autism spectrum. However, if anything happened to her, what would happen then? So she has written to say, what is the contingency plan? What is the emergency plan that you have in place if this happens? And she's still waiting on a response on that. And I know that's a difficult thing for the HSE to do, because potentially if there were thousands of people. So another thing we've also asked the HSE is, can we get protective equipment for family carers? The masks, the gel, the gloves, so that at least they're able to protect themselves.
And is that not available to carers?
Not
as
at the moment,
now.
Not for family carers. Now, it is available for home care workers. And I suppose we have a dual purpose, because we employ home care workers also. So we employ almost 700 home care workers across the country. So we are issuing them with the same guideline. We are issuing them with protective equipment, but we don't, that equipment is not there for family carers. So,
and is there like training available for carers? Because obviously this is a new reality and a new issue that they need to be able to deal with.
And again, the training that they're getting is what's on the HSE website. So how to put the mask, how to, as Dr. Rohn said, washing your hands properly, all of those things. But for carers, there's an extra dimension there. Because, God forbid, if anything happens to the carer, that's their biggest concern. What happens to the person I'm looking after?
And then, if in that scenario, if the carer tests positive for COVID-19, you would then be looking for somebody else to go into
a home
where we know that this virus has had a presence.
Absolutely.
And that would be another.
It would. And we're even looking to our own home care workers to see if any of them would be willing and available to do that, how we would support them, how we would train them to do that if that comes, you know, if that situation arises.
Nessa, you've been a full-time carer.
Yeah.
This must be in your head as well in terms of the challenges for
I think it's deeply concerning, and certainly we've asked that, particularly there's an interaction there, you're right, between family carers and home care, because there's going to have to be a natural calibration. When one gets sick, the other's going to have to step in. And so we've asked that we know that there are now provisions for, you know, extra sick pay. There might be an opportunity to change the force majeure leave from, you know, three days to a longer amount of time, that, you know, carers, home care workers would be included in all of that, and you know, that extends to people in all types of precarious work, and then that we work really hard to calibrate that for carers, because family carers are under so much pressure in the normal way.
Absolutely.
And this it presents such a challenge for them. And you know, they're already dealing with isolation and kind of lack of resources in the home.
Yeah, and their own health and well-being we did a Paying the Price research with UCD last year and the Irish College of Psychiatrists, which shows that caring full-time can have an impact on your own physical and mental health and well-being. And so our mantle is nobody should have to care alone, but now with this, carers will be more isolated, you know, in the long run. So we need to find a way to continue to support them and connect with them as well.
Yeah, Breed, you would...
Well, no, it's just the idea of testing all carers to see if they have contacted the virus, I think, is important. I meet carers a lot in the morning when I'm walking the dog. A lot of them work in Ballyferm at a home helping home carers, probably some of them
care workers. Employees, care yes, workers. Yeah.
And they're concerned that if they're visiting people in their 70s, 80s, 90s to help them out, they might be visiting five people a day. Are they carrying it themselves? So I think the mandatory testing for all people in
care. Is there, and I wonder, Rhona, do you know any, in terms of healthcare workers who are obviously on the front line are more likely to be, you know,
sure.
What's the word I was looking for, confronted with or are exposed to this? And obviously, care, as you say, going in and out of house after house of vulnerable people. Is there any plans to have tests available for those?
Yeah, so I mean, at the moment, all of the testing is done by the Viral Reference Lab in UCD. And as we increase the numbers of people we're testing, you know, that's going to put a huge strain on that service. So at the moment, HSE are looking at developing other laboratory facilities that can provide this test, because we're going to see, you know, a big increase in testing requirement over the next while. But it is important, you know, that we are testing the people that we need to be testing. And, you know, it may not be possible as this progresses, you know, to test absolutely everyone. It's interesting, like a few days ago, we had tested about 1,800 people, and thankfully 1.5% of those tests were positive. What that's really telling you is that in the community at the moment, you know, 2 days ago, the virus was not widespread in an asymptomatic population. So the first people to test are obviously symptomatic people, you know what I mean, where we really think that there's high suspicion that
there is, though, isn't there worrying data coming through now that people are shedding the virus while not having
absolutely
symptoms?
They can be. And I think what can happen is that as the numbers increase in community, you know, there will come a point when there are so many cases there that we don't need to test, because we'll say, well, look, this person has it, their disease is mild, they're going to be fine. And I think it comes back to 80% of people, thankfully, are going to have a mild, you know, to moderate disease. And then you're into, obviously, 15% having much more severe disease, and then 2 to 5% critical. But the vast majority of people, you know, are going to have, hopefully, a mild disease. They will recover and they will be well. So most people who are well now will continue to be well. There is a very vulnerable group, and that is, as we all know, the elderly patients and patients with comorbidities like lung disease and heart disease, chronic conditions like diabetes. But I think it is about, you know, using our resources as best we can. And if tomorrow we said we're going to test everyone, we would overwhelm our testing capacity, and that mightn't be the best use of our testing.
And we have learned from other countries, and if you talk to public health doctors, we had Anthony Staines in today for our Explainer podcast, and we have learned from places like China that while there were lockdowns in cities, it wasn't that totalitarian approach or draconian measures that actually worked. It has been more public health measures that have worked there, like figuring out how to step up testing. So they have done much more testing in a much more phased way and in a smart way. So you can't just blanket test everybody. Yeah, you do exactly. Have to do it in a clever way so that you're catching the correct people at the correct times. And I think when you're hearing both of you talk about the caring situation and the situation in hospitals, so much of this at the moment is public responsibility. There's the washing of the hands and all of that, but it is also it's not to have an individualistic response to something, not to say, oh well, I could get 10 masks there and that'll mask my whole family. It's to think about, well, actually that means there's no protective equipment for people who have people at home who need to be cared for, and not worry that you're not in lockdown yet, because it doesn't actually make sense to go into lockdown until the HSE is ready to make sure that we're all safe when we do that, because the knock-on effects of doing it too early could put more people in harm. So I think all of that public responsibility comes in. From my position as an editor, stop sharing things on WhatsApp that you don't know where they've come from. Stop sharing things on Facebook where you're not sure.
I think everyone has seen a WhatsApp that has completely...
that has told you something that it might allay your fears for a minute, but just stop and think, where is this coming from? I might trust the person who sent it to me, but it doesn't link to anything that, you know, is a medical journal that's sensible, that is quoting a mental public health doctor. So I think there's a lot of public responsibility and individual responsibility to act in a more collective manner.
Okay, let me give you a sense of what we are getting in on our text line. Hi Katie, what's wrong with our medical experts and our caretaker government when they allowed all those Italians from all over Italy to visit Ireland last weekend? We have 15,000 people attending Cheltenham who will fly back to Ireland and will surely bring back COVID-19 and distribute it throughout Ireland. We must isolate these people when they arrive back at our airport, says Gerry O'Connor in Rathfarnham. Katie, thousands of brackets, mainly Irishmen, travelled to Cheltenham defying common sense and contributing to our COVID spread. This is a quote, history is women following after men with a bucket. It's an Alan Bennett quote. Too true, says Mary. Again, Italy is one of the best medically equipped countries in Europe and is in deep trouble. We need to act now. I hate the word lockdown, but China gave us the example. Italy has just started shops, bars, restaurants. Will we ever learn, says David in Dublin. And lots more coming in on Cheltenham, which a lot of people are very uncomfortable about that. Holly, can I bring you in into this? How do you rate our response to this, the HSE's response, the department's response, the government's response?
Yeah, so the government's working with public health officials and following the expert medical advice, essentially. And I think, so every party is engaged in a cross-party process with senior health officials. And we believe that it's important that that's how it's done and that we follow expert advice. I think Sinead hit the nail on the head there that we need to take that approach, that we all follow the same guidelines. So it's in everybody's benefit, not just individuals or some groups. So we think it's really important that it's not politicised, that there is a cross-party approach to dealing with this, and that we absolutely have to trust the expert medical advice on this.
And have you been impressed so far with how, you know, how this has been progressed?
I think, you know, there's obviously, you can hear the public fear and the worry that enough isn't being done, and perhaps more communication might be a good method for dealing with that, because we're talking about, for example, schools closing and stuff and people calling for why hasn't that already happened? And maybe there's reasons for it. Like you say, that when the time is right, based on all the pressure that we put on the healthcare system, if children are out of school, perhaps they'll be with their grandparents and they're a more vulnerable part of society in terms of contracting this. And in addition to that, a lot of our healthcare staff might then need to be at home with their children. So I think we need more communication as to why decisions are being made. And I think we do need to still trust that the right decisions are being made. I don't feel as a politician I can come in and override a healthcare expert on this and say that I know better.
Can I just ask you, in relation to the schools, and we talk, obviously all of this is about evidence-based decision-making. Now, I know we are still learning an awful lot about this virus, but am I right in saying, certainly the research papers that I've read that have come out from the early cases in China, is that children don't seem to be good vectors for this. They don't get sick themselves and they don't seem to be transmitting it to their parents or to adults. Yeah. So the huge focus on shutting down schools, is that the right way to go?
Yeah, no, it's been an interesting profile, you know, in this virus, is that you're absolutely right, that young children seem to be asymptomatic, not being infected. And thankfully, when we look at mortality rates, you know, children
no child
10
under 9
exactly
has,
are not represented. So, you know, and that's obviously very reassuring. In terms of, you know, closing schools, so again, all the decisions made are really carefully thought about by public health experts, you know, and you're looking at getting the timing right of all these measures, because if you come in too early, you know, you have massive social impact when you make these decisions, because you're absolutely right. If you close schools, then parents need to be at home. And if you close them a week ago, would there have been any great benefit? You know what I mean? But there might be a great benefit in 2 weeks' time. So we have to be proportionate and careful as the timing of everything. And the other thing is, if you come in immediately with all kinds of myriad of measures and then people get complacent and they get sick of them, the time that people really need to be exercising them maybe is the time when they don't. So I do think there has to be a proportionate and a phased response. There have been kind of different patterns, you know, in different parts of the world again, and we have seen different mortality rates reported. Italy is a particularly worrying, you know, example. And again, we're trying to study this and go, well, why has Italy got such a high mortality rate and what happened there? And there's a few thoughts on that, you know, and some of them are, you know, perhaps the population are much older, and there's no doubt about that. They have a particularly older population for sure. Italians are very tactile, you know, and they kiss when they're meeting and they hug and you have a lot of contact. You know, some people feel that perhaps in the early days that, you know, some cases had gone undetected, had been through the healthcare system, and so therefore healthcare workers and a whole range of people were infected, but also that there was a lot of community transmission before it really came to the fore. So therefore you had a very sudden, what felt like a very sudden and acute amplification, and then a whole number of cases occurring at the same time, which literally overwhelmed the health system. And that's what we're trying to avoid here, is that you have a sudden, really high rate where you overwhelm the health system and then you see mortality rates rise because you are having difficulty managing ventilated patients. You know,
well, I mean, that's what we're hearing. And I saw a paper that was put out by the Association of ICU Consultants, whatever the equivalent in Italy is today, basically setting out criteria for triage and suggesting that there may become, and this is the situation they're now in, which is so shocking, that they may have to, but they're rationing the ICU, the ventilators, and that there may become an age ceiling where older people just will not be offered respirator. That's a very shocking thing for the northern part of Italy.
Yeah, no, it is, and very shocking for the healthcare workers, you know what I mean, in that situation where they are looking at ways of, you know, managing what seems like an impossible situation. I think when it comes to intensive care, always there are difficult decisions to be made, you know, and we have very difficult decisions every day in our intensive care units in this country, you know, outside of COVID, as to when to place very vulnerable patients on ventilation and what is the likely outcome. So we are familiar with those difficult decisions. The problem will be if we overwhelm our ICU capacity. And that's why so much effort has gone in recently to
increase. It's unthinkable, really, isn't it, that you would have to make those kind of decisions.
That capacity, but
yeah, Nessa, the Green Party put out a statement today basically calling for a whole raft of, that to move on to the next phase, really, if you were to put it in shorthand.
Well, the World Health Organization kind of said themselves, which is not necessarily that we were calling for specific measures, but we listed a whole lot of measures that we should now be considering. And look, we agree that we should be following the advice of the Chief Medical Officer and following the advice at the HSE. But there is, you know, another dimension to this, which is the kind of social dimension. And, you know, we're not unmindful of the fact that there is pressures put on the system in terms of like the economic impact of this and the social impact of this. And those have to be considered by decision makers. And so, you know, we wanted to say that, look, we see what's happening in Italy and that incredibly serious situation. These are some of the measures that they have put in place. Can we talk about them?
Mm. All right. So you're not suggesting that we're handling it wrong as of now, but you want to...
Look,
I mean, the sense I got from that statement was we need to start closing.
One of your suggestions was closing
bars and restaurants from 6 p.m. for 2 weeks, closing schools
away. Which is something that they've done in Italy. And that kind of social distancing taken to kind of a more formal stage. And I think our sense is that, you know, we need to take this really, really seriously. And that there's a certain kind of inertia at the moment and that, you know, everything should be on the table and we should be moving.
I do think one of the things we have to remember, so say the texters there who are talking about some of the more draconian measures like closing things down or, you know, looking at people where they're coming back from in flights. Like Taiwan made sure that the Chinese, what they saw in China didn't happen in Taiwan, even though it's a bordering country. But the data collection that they do, even though it's a democracy, it's not a totalitarian state, the data collection they do just wouldn't fly in a democracy like ours. Like, you know, if you see the uproar about something like the public services card, if you then try and collect data like they did in Taiwan, because they had a protocol put in place after SARS that they would collect data on people and where they had travelled, how well they were, and people were literally giving a pass to say you could travel X, Y or Z. So if they're the kind of measures that people are calling for now, they take a lot more planning than just getting to an airport and asking someone, have you been to Cheltenham? I think there is a lot of realistic discomfort about Cheltenham, and I think that is absolutely fair enough. But trying to take people's personal responsibility or personal freedoms off them for this situation is a bit more difficult here than it is if you're in Taiwan or China.
Surely the context in which there was concern and you know, problems around the public services card has changed utterly now, and people would be more willing to cooperate. Breed, you're nodding.
Yeah, I think people would be willing to cooperate, but I share a bit of the concern that NASA's expressed there, because I agree we have to listen to public health officials and we have to take the science serious. But sometimes decisions that go beyond just the public health measures, like, for example, should we ban foreign travel? May we get to that stage? We don't know. There was a huge amount of anxiety about the flights coming from Italy when the match was cancelled, but they still came. And now, de facto, there is no flights to and from northern Italy. Maybe we should be taking measures more before we get to the point where, as Rona says, we have to be proportionate and we have to take them at the right time. But are we sure? How can we be sure that the right time is the right time? And shouldn't we be taking measures like taking over all private hospitals, private the clinics and their staff and having them available to do the sort of work that Rona's talking about, the intensive care work. Those are kind of measures that go beyond, there's economic decisions and there are political decisions, but I think they need to be made sooner rather than later.
Holly.
Yeah, I think like what Nasa and Breed are both saying really speaks to a lot of the public and the feelings that they're having that maybe enough isn't being done and that there's specific things that should be done. Like we can look at Italy and the bars closing and different things like that. But I think what we just established was that there is reasons for that, that the medical experts have looked into and they've looked at Italy. And for us to come in and say that we perhaps have a better idea without all of that information seems like it's strange. And there is this forum for all, it's cross-party, and like the Green Party leader is a member of it. So if there's concerns like that, perhaps raising them on that cross-party
committee.
Well, we have
seen a number of medical experts across the country diverge from the official advice. So I think the idea of shutting down debate around this is actually more dangerous.
I'm not shutting down debate, but as a place to raise this issue in that cross-party meeting with all party leaders is probably a better place than a press release out to the public, which probably feeds into the worry. It does. But if we take a cross-party approach and trust healthcare experts and raise issues in that...
You'd be supporting a national government.
If you want to raise an issue about this without causing hysteria, but getting the message across with senior officials, senior health officials,
I think
in that committee,
creating hysteria is really irresponsible.
Okay, Nessa, just 1 second. Finish the point, Holly, and then I'll let you back in, Nessa.
Yeah, because all party leaders, including Eamon Ryan, are currently engaged in a cross-party process with senior public health officials.
You think that was a more appropriate channel?
They're due to meet again on Friday and again on Monday. There was one a few days ago, and I think that I was shocked that that was the way that the Green Party went about raising this issue, to put it out in the form of a press release instead of in that meeting where it can be discussed with senior health officials.
We have just talked about how important communication with the public is. Public health is very much tied up with how we communicate. And the idea that all of those decisions and all of that discourse happens in a room with party leaders is really, really problematic. And I think setting it up that somehow asking questions of that process and, you know, and having public discourse about it is promoting hysteria is a problem. I think we need to be able to have some kind of a reasonable debate about it. We didn't make specific recommendations. We're not in a position to do that. What we said is this should be part of the public discourse. We see it in other countries where Italy is saying that they didn't act fast enough in some areas. Now, the thing around schools, fair enough, but you know, we should be able to talk about this in a grown-up way.
Yeah. But it's not just politicians either. Senior health officials in those meetings too. That's the whole purpose of
it. There's senior health officials who are diverging from that as well, and they're out in the public saying that too. So, you know, I think having a debate is not unreasonable.
Rona,
So it's just going back to the whole idea of, you know, completely blanket requisitioning hospitals. I think we have to remember that, you know, one of the difficult things about this is it will not be just COVID, you know, coming through our hospitals. People are still going to have heart attacks. They're still going to have strokes. They're still going to have appendicitis. So we've got to be able to run our emergency services in parallel while increasing our capacity to deal with COVID. And the real place we need to increase capacity, and to be fair to healthcare workers across the board, to be fair to managers, to be fair to politicians, there's been huge support to increase the ICU services and huge funding made available for those very important developments, things that are really going to help us. We have to be careful that the things that we do actually have good impact, you know, and actually do prevent transmission, and that they do have a positive impact on outcomes.
But can I,
Important thing is personal responsibility and people avoiding exposure in the first place, self-isolating appropriately, not going to hospital if they are mild symptoms, they think they're COVID, ringing GP, not coming to hospital to be tested. There is testing. The ambulance service has done an amazing job. They are going out to people's houses where people don't immediately acquire hospitalization of symptoms, and they're testing them. And that is the single
personal
most important way that we are going to prevent transmission.
Well, Breed, I just want you to come back to Nessa's point, which is, I think, a valid discussion to have in terms of there is this view that we all have to pull on the green jersey now. We nobody questions the information we're getting, that we must accept that these are the experts and that it's somehow, you know, dangerous to raise questions about that.
I don't accept that at all. And as Nasa said, there are experts who diverge from the experts' views And if you backtrack about a week ago, there was no such thing as sick pay for anybody who had to self-isolate. We all the parties kicked up a stink in the dial about that, because there's a 6-day waiting period before you get any social protection. And that was a political pressure that forced them to reconsider that and deliver the €305 for everybody who has to self-isolate. Now, I'm not sure how this works, but my understanding is that you have to be instructed to self-isolate by the HSE or a doctor. And if that's the case, that can have a negative impact, because if one feels feverish, has a dry cough, has those symptoms, and maybe was in contact with somebody and you can't get to a doctor, you shouldn't go to the doctor, all that stuff, then you should be able to stay at home. And workers need to know that they can stay at home and not worry about the mortgage yeah. or the rent or being evicted or not being able to pay the bills. They need to be able to self-isolate if this is going to work. Yeah. And so there should be a social guarantee to workers that if they have to self-isolate, they're not going to suffer yeah. financially.
Catherine, do you know?
I do. Well, I know that we've been told if a person chooses to self-isolate, then they may not be entitled to that payment. Yeah. So that is the case. So they do have to have medical
instruction.
Yeah.
And how does that work then if your GP says don't come near the surgery? So you have to get on get this mobile unit out to you. Is that
so? Effectively, yeah. So if you think, say, if you're at home and you know you're not critically ill, you're symptomatic, and the symptoms we're looking for are fever, cough, shortness of breath. More serious symptoms would be symptoms of pneumonia or hypoxia, you know, but the main symptoms will be fever, cough, shortness of breath that prompt people. And so what we're asking people to do is, you know, you ring your GP first and discuss it with your GP, who will make an assessment on the phone as to whether you likely have COVID. And that'll involve a questionnaire, you know, about contact with people, you know, whether you've travelled, all of that. If you can't get hold of your GP, you dial 112 or 999. The same assessment can take place so that you can be assessed as to whether or not testing is appropriate. And then if testing is appropriate, the ambulance service have been superb. They are going to people's houses, they are testing, and people are getting those
results. Okay, but two questions on that, Ronan. One is, if you haven't mm-hmm. been abroad, you just have symptoms mm-hmm. of a cold, basically, and there's no other reason to believe, but I mean, you could easily have bumped into somebody or had a thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are you likely to be offered a test or to be recommended to have a test in those circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, if your symptoms add up, then most GPs are likely to offer testing. But regardless of offering testing, this is where the common sense comes in. If you have a fever, a cough, shortness of breath, and think you have a respiratory illness consistent with COVID, then you self.
No, but our point is,
how do you get your
payment for that?
Because most low-paid workers live day to day, they have no resources to rely on.
So you're going to have to wait. Are you going to have to wait for a positive COVID-19 test to come back to be?
It doesn't have to be positive.
No, it doesn't have to be positive. Your GP can still sign you off and say this is appropriate, and you can still get certified without having a positive test.
Without having any test.
Yeah, because we cannot use testing for COVID as a qualification for, you know, either sick pay or cover. That's not going to work. I think what the government is trying to do is make sure that the consideration about going to work or not going to work is whether or not you're going to get paid. That the consideration as to whether you go to work or not is whether or not you're symptomatic and likely to infect your co-colleagues and shouldn't be in the workplace. And that's what's underlying this. And one of the really important things is that we all work together. And I think that, you know, questions are great, conversations are really important, because actually they stimulate our debate and they stimulate, you know, the things that we need to be asking. But we do need to really work together at this point, and we do need to support the health service. We need to support government. We need to support everyone who's trying to make this better. It's uncharted territory for everyone. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do everything perfectly, but we are going to really do our best and try very hard. We have the benefit of other people's experience, good and bad, and we are learning from that, but we must work together.
And just on the numbers, Bloomberg crunched the numbers this morning, Bloomberg Business, on the financial packages that countries have put in place. Now, throwing money at things doesn't always mean that you're doing the right thing. But if you're looking at the figures, Ireland's package per person is actually quite a bit higher than what's being seen in, say, Germany and the US. I think four times higher than Germany's financial package that they've put in place at the moment. So there has been money put in place. Again, it's always the effectiveness and the efficiency of that money, and also afterwards, if people are able to access it in a timely manner, because that's what's going to be important. So it's not saying that all the answers are there, but the money has been put in place.
Just one last text there. The public is not hysterical. We are quite calm and our brains are still functional. Children may need reassurance. Adults need to hear facts. Our opinions should should contribute to decisions. And a couple of more texts in along those lines.
I think a lot of people have said that, but then you hear Rona saying that people are stealing protective equipment from hospitals. So like people can feel that themselves, but there is definitely people who, you know, if we were in the pub last week and some people still weren't washing their hands in the bathroom. So, you know, a lot of individual people will feel like, you know, they're doing the right thing, but all of these messages haven't got across to everybody. So I think that's one of the things.
There's a great website, just, you know, the Health Protection Surveillance Centre has a brilliant website, which has, you know, specific information for healthcare professionals, but also for patients. And it's really, really good.
What's the address?
www.hpsc.ie. It's the Health Protection Surveillance Centre, but it's a really good source of factual information, because I think that caller is absolutely right. People do want the facts and they want as much practical advice as possible.
Yeah. OK, we'll take a break there, but we want to talk about government formation and women and power after.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Good town this evening.
And you're welcome back. The Green Party Parliamentary Party met this afternoon and agreed that in the light of unfolding coronavirus crisis, the party are calling on all parties to suspend discussions on forming a majority government and work towards forming a crisis national government to be reviewed in 3 months. Nessa. What if where? Because I mean, you no doubt have noticed that there isn't exactly been a rush to support you in this endeavour. Mary Lou MacDonald, very unenthusiastic today. Fine Gael spokesperson saying we need a majority government for this crisis situation. Same line coming out of Fianna Fáil. Are you just going to bin that idea now and get back to the talks?
No. Look, I never stood on a doorstep and said I wouldn't go in with any particular party. I wouldn't go in with Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael or Sinn Féin or anybody like that. The only thing I ever said to people and I promised them is that we would go into government based on the policies that we presented in our manifesto. And I don't feel that the best use of our time over the next few weeks is to be sitting. It's what we want to do. And what we promised people faithfully we would do is to go line by line through every department and go, yeah, we need more solar panels. And no, we don't want less local government. That it's not the time for that right now. Right. So we feel that we do need a government that's strong and we do need a government with a mandate. And so a national government would provide that and would provide those voices that have a mandate to make decisions. But what I don't want to see and what I think the larger three parties are saying is that we're going to cobble together and fast track some kind of a majority government. We won't have the time to talk about policy. Policy doesn't matter to us. The principles that we ran in the election on don't matter to us. The strategic planning for the nation over the next 5 years and the huge crises that we face don't matter to us. We're going to cobble this together and spend a week arguing about who is Taoiseach and how we can divvy up the ministries. That is not how we want to spend our time. We're in the middle of a national crisis and we should be all focusing on coronavirus, and we think a national government would achieve that.
So are you out?
I think that, look, we're not in a frame of mind to be going into government formation talks right now. And we think a national government is the way to go.
OK, but I'm asking the question. Are you out in terms of, we know that there's been a huge momentum in the last couple of days in terms of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael finally saying, OK, right, we'll start with the talks. They have their negotiating teams being put in place. In terms of that project.
Yeah.
Is the Green Party no longer willing to go along with that?
In formation, we're not going into talks around that. I think we've all identified in the last, even the last 24 hours, all spokespeople were coming together into a room going, oh my God, in my brief, we need to deal with this issue around coronavirus. And so we will be still talking about policy with people because we feel that we have something to contribute in terms of the national crisis that we're facing. But, you know, government formation is not on our minds.
Could it come back on your minds in a week or two when
Fine Gael do a deal with each other?
I don't foresee it.
You in your view, you are not.
No, right now, like the statement we put out is what we agreed as a group. And so right now I'm only speaking for myself, but I am not. I have a high risk in husband and all of this. So I'm at home, you know, sterilising things. I am not in a frame of mind to be talking about solar panels while people are dying.
Breed.
Well, I think the it appears to the people that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are cynically using the virus to hurry up a deal for, you know, with each other. But I
is that fair though, Breed? I mean, to say cynically, I mean, surely there is a real crisis here, and that they're acting in they say in the national interest.
They do say they're acting in the national interest, but the speed at which they were not talking to each other, about to talk to each other, and now they're
well.
Getting
to be fair to Fianna Fáil, they wanted to talk to Fine Gael basically from
they
the
did.
Day after the
yeah,
election.
Absolutely,
so this
and
was this
Fine
was
didn't Fine
Gael.
To anyone,
we're
understand.
Not talking to anyone. Yeah,
yeah. But I don't understand why the Green Party would go in with them anyway. I don't think they should, because if
we've
you
had
look
this
at,
conversation
yeah,
a few
yeah,
times.
Loads of times. I mean, if you look at their record on what you're passionate about, what you're set up for, which is climate and climate change and the environment, absolutely appalling, and it'll go nowhere. You'll be swamped by them. So I hope you don't go in with them. I'm sure they'll find some buddies in their gene pool in the independents.
What about the government of national unity?
Well, I don't think that would work. I think it'd be too unwieldy in a crisis like this, but we should be continue to do what Holly was talking about earlier on, the daily meetings with the Department of Health, with the health advisors, with the party leaders.
Okay, but if this option is off the table, we know the numbers aren't there for the left-led government. So are you content then to roll along with the government we have?
Not at all.
I know
no.
We don't constitutionally have a caretaker government, but the
but
government that's there.
That, yeah.
And because... Mm-hmm. I don't see any other options on the table.
Well, there's two cohorts of independents there, and there's enough of their, that's what I'm saying, there's enough of their own gene pool, ex-Fianna Fáil, ex-Fine Gael, independents there, that they could court into a government if the Greens don't go in with them.
Their point is that they need a government with a stable majority because of the huge decisions that are likely to be facing them and to have a serious mandate in the weeks and months ahead.
But why would the independents not give them a stable majority?
Why indeed?
Yeah. I mean, they've had
so that would be your preferred.
The president would show years. That's generally not what happens.
Well, they've
so.
Had independence with them for 4 years prior to this, from 2016 to
that
2020.
That was really only stable because of the Brexit question. Like, if we didn't have Brexit, like, coronavirus might work in the same way.
It was
way,
stable because Fianna Fáil gave them
I was going to say it was stable.
But only because of Brexit. It wouldn't have been stable with Fianna Fáil if Brexit wasn't there.
Holly, where do you stand on this government of national unity?
I'd agree with Breed. I think it's very experimental, and I don't think it's a good time to try something experimental. In terms of obviously the sentiment is that we need to deal with the coronavirus situation, and like I already said, we believe that the cross-party process with senior health officials remains to be the best form to formulate a national response at the moment.
So again, I'll ask you the same question I asked Breed. Are you content to have this country facing into the weeks and months ahead of this unprecedented crisis with a government that basically doesn't have a mandate? Or do you think it would be better if Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael could pull together some kind of a majority and move on?
I think it's really important that all parties can work together on this issue. You know, that we
keep
this forum going.
I'm saying, what government do you think is the best government to handle this crisis, given who we have elected to this role?
A minority left government.
No, sorry.
What would realistic option was the best option to do this?
Like, take the COVID-19 situation out of it. We're in the same situation where we were before. Like, two of the big parties need to step up and take it seriously before
but
we can form a government.
COVID-19 changes everything.
Yeah.
Yes, and in dealing with that, we believe the best form to deal with that is the one that's been set up. Like, to form an experimental government
the problem is this government has no mandate. And from the very second we stood into the last week, we were talking about the fact that there are a whole load of issues around COVID-19 that are not just health issues. They're social, they're economic, and they will involve almost every department. And the idea that, you know, you're going to have decision making happen, but by a government that has lost its mandate, there's no working around that. There's no cross-party, you know, group that has the chief medical officer that's going to solve. We're not going to square that circle. The only way to square that circle is to either to form a majority government or form a national government. There's plenty of versions of them out there.
OK, Sinead, what's going to happen?
I just think putting together any kind of, like, you're talking about it being unwieldy, like a national government making decisions. Like, how would that work?
Work on the hunt.
But how would it work? No,
well,
I mean,
no,
how would it work Ireland?
No, look, it does work in Ireland. It works in the north.
No, how does it work here? Like, literally, if you walk in and you're faced with Simon Harris, Leo Varadkar, Micheál Martin, Holly Cairns, Catherine Murphy, Breed Smith, you all have various different opinions on absolutely everything.
Yeah.
How do you make a decision on one thing, never mind the 25 things you decide every hour?
I think that's a bit disingenuous, because we already live in a world of non-one-party government. Like, we already have to work in a collaborative method. If you took Dahan, you'd have four ministers from all of the three large parties and three more ministers from various other parties.
No, how would you make a decision, though, on things that you... Like, that's how it would form. But how would you make a decision when you all have extremely different opinions on how things should operate?
Well, this is based around the coronavirus. And so I think the decision making.
But if you're a national government,
that.
You have to make decisions on things that aren't just the coronavirus, which I think is Holly's point, that if you're working, if you're thinking of just the coronavirus, then the current situation works. If you're thinking about other things, then how would you make a decision on housing policy when you all have very different
ideas?
Well,
that's the point, though, isn't it? Is that we have a government right now who's going to have to be making all of those decisions that has no mandate. So that's not a government of the people. They weren't voted in by anybody.
I agree on that point. I just don't see how the other one works.
I had intended having my panel, all female panel of six women, to talk about more about politics and power and policy and what would change if women were in cabinet. And do you think, Catherine, you haven't been I mean, you've dealt with governments over the years and politicians of every gender, I'm sure.
Yep.
What's your sense of, would it change? I mean, if cabinets were more gender balanced, would it make a difference, or is it down to the individual?
Certainly dealing with individuals, I think it's down to the individual. I've never come across a situation where I felt someone wasn't doing a good job because they were male or female. We go in, we lobby government, we get the same response. I suppose for us, it's if the individual has a background in caring, or it's something in their own past, or, you know, they'll show more empathy and more consideration towards it. So,
but do you think that carers have been left behind politically?
I do.
Because
absolutely.
It's a predominantly female.
Yeah. Well, I think they've been left behind by successive governments over the last number of years. They've actually gone backwards in terms of what supports they get. But I don't believe that's necessarily because of their gender. Like, the breakup or the breakdown of carers is 62% female, 38% male. And that actually, the male, it's increasing over the last number of years. So I don't think it's down to the fact that they're females that they've been left behind. I think it's because carers are almost this hidden workforce who are not seen. You know, they're not out there. They're not lobbying themselves. They're not striking like other groups. So I think it's taken for granted what they do. And unless they shout or we shout for them, they're ignored.
And it's very isolating work. You're left on your own most of the time.
And it's very tiring. So it's the last thing they want to do is be outside the door protesting when they're just getting through the day caring.
Exactly. And how can you? How can you leave your
person behind?
Exactly. Holly, tell us, because I heard you telling the story last week at an event we were at. What was said to you the day you first went into the council chamber when you won your seat in Cork County Council?
First day there, didn't know what was going on, sat down in my new seat, and I watched a colleague, a fellow councillor who'd been there for a very long time, go around and congratulate a couple of other newly elected members. And the three that he congratulated before me happened to be male, and he sort of said, "Well done, great campaign, well deserved congratulations," to all of them in various ways, and then came to me and patted me on the shoulder and said, "Well done, you look great."
That's a huge achievement. It looked great.
So that was good.
Delighted with that?
I know, and then I don't take it as a compliment.
Women that don't take a compliment.
And I think that's one of the biggest problems when we talk about sexism, or we try and talk about sexism, I think is a better way of putting it, because when you say something like, "I'm so annoyed that somebody told me that I looked great today," sounds very... You know, it's very easy for someone to say, you can't take a compliment.
Or it just sounds petty, like, you know, get over yourself.
Absolutely. But, you know, for example, if you're entering into Cork County Council, as an example, and there's a group of people standing around and they're talking about the development of a project, and you arrive and you want to join in that conversation to see what's going on, to essentially do your job, and then you're met with the conversation stops and somebody comments on your appearance, that's a really difficult thing to move on from. And what are you supposed to say? You can't complain about it afterwards. But I think what you're talking about, we're talking about representation. So is it important that we have women? It's all in the word. If we're not represented at those decision-making tables, areas where of in the workforce that are female-dominated are underserved, like care, like childcare, you know, disability support services.
I'm just conscious we're almost over the time. Rona, you rose to a very high profile position in a very tough profession. Mm. What was that? Was there, did you come across any of this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had questions like, what do you call a master in a skirt? And I got great advice once on underwear, and I was advised not to wear thongs because, you know, apparently if you lean forward, you might see them. So I had all kinds of things. But, you know, the much more objective stuff really worries me. And just to follow your point, Holly, the cost of childcare is prohibitive for women working and taking place in our society and in the workplace. We're not as well representative as we'd like to be at political level, and that does affect the kind of things we discuss. We have a gender pay gap. You know, there's a bill that's being introduced at the moment by Vanna Bachik, which is addressing a gender payback or pay gap. 20% of CEOs in Ireland are women, you know, and even less when we look at the big companies. The pink tax, you know, England last week just took away the 5% VAT for luxury goods off tampons. Look at domestic violence and the number of women who are murdered and the number of women, 1 in 8 women who are affected by domestic violence. But if you look globally, you know, we are really worried, and rightly we're really worried at the moment that we've over 4,000 deaths from COVID virus. But just remember, 300,000 women will die this year in childbirth globally.
Okay. Yeah. On that tragic note, but it's an issue, we will bring you all back and talk about these issues. But I have to go now. Tonight's programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Mark McGrath was on sound. I want to thank my panel for joining me this evening. I want to thank you all for listening, and hand you over now to Col Murray on Late Date.